Thanks. So I'm going to give kind of a big picture talk that doesn't assume much background, but I hope to convey some of the excitement as to what's going on in cosmology right now. The talk will have sort of observational bias, since I'm more of a data person than a theorist. So I'm going to start out by talking about the standard cosmological model, which will be review for a lot of you. But the basic picture is as follows. So the thermal history of the universe is that the universe expands and cools, so that at early times, the universe is very dense and very hot. At sufficiently early times, the universe is a plasma of protons and electrons, with small disturbances, which start out very tiny, of order of fractional density 10 to the minus 5, propagating as sound waves. When the plasma cools to a temperature of around 3,000 Kelvin, then protons and electrons can combine to form neutral hydrogen. This event is called recombination, but a better word, I think, would be combination. The universe becomes transparent. At this point, the gravitational growth of perturbations is no longer compensated by pressure support in the plasma. So the 10 to the minus 5 perturbations can grow gravitationally to the order 1 perturbations that we see today. Nowadays we see matter bunched up into halos, galaxies, bound structures. The expansion history is described by the FRW metric, at least to zeroth order where perturbations are neglected. The scale factor, A of t, which measures the physical distance between two points in the universe, how that physical distance changes with time as the universe expands. The scale factor evolves by Friedman's equation, which is one of Einstein's equations for this metric, which just says that the Hubble rate, or the fractional rate of change of the scale factor, is proportional to the square root of the matter density. The matter density is given by a radiation, is the sum of a radiation component, which grows proportional to a to the minus 4, a matter component, which grows as a to the minus 3, and a cosmological constant piece, which is constant or a to the 0. So this is a closed set of equations that you can integrate to get the expansion history. To start introducing parameters of the standard model, we usually parameterize this expansion history by three parameters. There are four here, but they're not independent since the sum of the omegas has to equal 1. The Hubble parameter at the Hubble rate at redshift 0, i.e. today, and the fraction of the total matter density today, and that's in the form of cosmological constant lambda, cold dark matter C, and baryonic matter B. If you plot the expansion history with time, you can see small breaks here where the expansion history changes as the universe transitions from being dominated by radiation, being dominated by cold and baryonic matter, and being dominated by cosmological constant. To finish describing the cosmological model, I have to tell you something about the perturbations. So we start the universe slightly perturbed away from the FRW metric by what's called an adiabatic perturbation. I won't write down the definition in detail, but physically what adiabatic means is that a local observer in different parts of the universe, different local observers in different parts of the universe, experience the same history, but there's no global clock syncing them up. So in particular, different clocks or choices of time slicing can differ, and this allows us to define a variable zeta, which is called the adiabatic curvature perturbation. So the precise definition of zeta is that if we compare two time slicings, one where the local density is the clock, so we slice on surfaces of constant density, and another slicing, which is spatially flat, then the difference between those two slicings is zeta, and this variable completely characterizes the adiabatic perturbation. Zeta is a statistical quantity. It's a nearly scale invariant Gaussian field. What this means is it's the following prescription for simulating a random realization of zeta. Each Fourier mode of the field is an independent Gaussian random variable with a variance whose dependence on wave number k is a power law. An index of minus 3 in the power law, or ns equals 1, would be the scale invariant case where If I were to zoom in on a small subvolume here and blow it up to the size of the original volume, the statistics would appear the same. We observe a small deviation from S to NS equals 1, so our universe is not precisely scale invariant, but it's still a power law within current observational errors. So that's the standard cosmological model. That's the description of the thermal history, expansion history, and the initial perturbations that seed structure. It has 6 parameters, 5 of which I've already introduced, and then there's a 6th nuisance parameter, which is important for the CMB, which is the redshift, the mean redshift when stars form and their UV radiation ionizes neutral hydrogen to turn it back into protons and electrons. That process affects the CMB somewhat, and it's, for cosmological purposes, it's a nuisance parameter that you need to marginalize over. Okay. Next, I'm going to start talking about the observations a little bit, and I'm going to frame this entirely in the context of the CMB, mostly for purposes of time, but also because the CMB has been our most powerful cosmological probe to date. And so to zeroth order, what we know about observational cosmology is largely largely boils down to what we know about the CMB, and it's really been a success story in cosmology. Unfortunately, a success story that's nearing conclusion. Okay, so the CMB is the relic radiation from the early universe when it was a plasma. When the universe turns transparent, photons free stream where we observe them as the CMB today. Because the early universe is so close to homogeneous, the perturbations are of order 10 to the minus 5, the CMB looks almost perfectly uniform in temperature. If you were to dig down in instrumental sensitivity, the next thing you would see beyond this uniform temperature radiation in all directions is the dipole pattern that just comes because the Earth has some overall motion relative to the surface of last scattering where the CMB is generated. And if you were to dig down beneath that, you would see the cosmological anisotropy, which is more or less a snapshot of the plasma when it recombined. So here's a hot spot in the CMB. That's a region where the plasma was a little hotter than average, and similarly for a cold spot. To analyze the CMB, I want to flesh out the description a little bit just by talking about what quantities we measure. Since we're talking about the CMB on a spherical sky, the relevant Fourier decomposition is the spherical harmonic representation. We measure the temperature anisotropy as a function of angle on the sky, and write that as a linear combination of spherical harmonics. So instead of representing the CMB in this pixel space basis, we represent it as this as the set of coefficients ALM in the spherical harmonic basis. And so the L, if we measure an ALM, the value of L was rough. We've measured the CMB fluctuations in a mode where the value of L is roughly the number of wavelengths in one 360-degree trip around the sky. So here are some randomly generated modes at L equals 2, 10, and 100, respectively. So the standard cosmological model predicts that the ALMs that we measure are a 2D Gaussian random field. Symmetry demands that their two-point expectation value or power spectrum is diagonal in L and M. It's easy to see that the ALMs are going to be a 2D Gaussian field because they're linearly generated from a 3D Gaussian field in the standard model. The power spectrum CL is what we measure. The individual ALMs, of course, are random, but their mean, or the mean of their square, is a quantity that we can measure and plot. And this power spectrum is sensitive to cosmological parameters. So just to give kind of an example of how this works, here's the CMB power spectrum for a model that's not exactly the current one, but close. And I've slightly perturbed it by just changing the cosmological constant a bit, leaving all the high redshift parameters, the density of matter and baryons and so on, at high redshift fixed. And you can see that what that's done is change the CMB power spectrum. In this case, there's a characteristic angular scale, which has moved out to larger values of L or smaller angular separations because the distance to the surface of last scattering has become larger as we change the expansion history. Here's a slide that contains about 30 years of difficult measurements. Not every CMB experiment is plotted here, only recent ones. This power spectrum has been measured to incredible precision through this series of peaks. The measurements are fully consistent with the standard model in a sense that I'll explain shortly. And here are the parameter constraints. So cosmology has progressed to the point where most of these parameters in the standard six-parameter model are measured to an accuracy of say, a few percent. I find it remarkable that our understanding of cosmology over the last 30 years can be compressed into such a simple model in such a short sequence of measurements. But let's not forget that this contained in these six lines are some of the deepest mysteries of modern physics. The fact that we have baryons in the universe at all is due to a net baryon versus anti-baryon asymmetry. Understanding exactly how that happened in the early universe is a deep problem where there's competing ideas but no detailed explanation. The fact that we have dark matter is just a complete surprise that we've all gotten used to. The CMB, by the way, shows evidence for dark matter at around 30 sigma. You can't get the CMB peaks even remotely correct without having dark matter in your model, or something that mimics the effects of dark matter. The cosmological constant, of course, the cosmological constant problem is one of the most pressing problems of modern physics and was also a complete surprise. The initial conditions, these two parameters parameterize the initial conditions. The existence of Gaussian, nearly scale invariant, but not quite, initial perturbations is a very interesting phenomenon that has attracted some competing explanations that I'll talk about and hints at physics beyond our standard model. Although the model was extremely simple, it contains really some of the deepest mysteries in theoretical physics. And understanding sharpening our understanding of any of these four phenomena would be a huge breakthrough. When I say that the CMB is consistent with the six-parameter model, you have to define precisely what that means. And to define it, you have to have some idea of what type of deviation you're looking for. So here are some parameters. This is not a complete list, but I just want to keep the talk reasonably short. We can parameterize, for example, deviation from the standard expansion history by introducing a curvature parameter. That's found to be consistent with zero. Another thing you might ask is whether the neutrino mass, which is assumed to be small in the standard model, we didn't need it as an independent parameter, whether that is observed to be different from zero. The answer is no. Likewise, we can add multiple species of neutrino. The CMB measures the number of neutrino species to be three within statistical errors. You can add a stochastic background of gravity waves. I'll talk about that shortly. You can change the power spectrum of the initial conditions. I said that was a power law. You can look for non-power law dependence by asking whether the exponent in the power law can run with k. You can change the dark energy or the late time acceleration to be something other than a cosmological constant, which has an equation of state parameter minus one. And finally, you can look for deviations from Gaussian initial conditions. Non-Gaussianity can be parameterized in a number of ways, but these three parameters called F and Ls are the most widely studied, and those are all found to be consistent with zero. So that's sort of a snapshot of where we are so far. In the next part of the talk, I want to talk about where cosmology is headed in the future. This will somewhat reflect my personal biases. I can't tell you about everything. I'll just tell you about some things that I personally find interesting. When thinking about the future, I've recently kind of converted from being a pessimist by default to being an optimist by default. When looking at futuristic projections, It's easy to be pessimistic when you think about all the obstacles that stand in the way. I mean, many of the things that I'm about to talk about will actually require, if you look under the hood, requiring a ton of solving a ton of technical problems. But the historical evidence suggests, I would say, a perspective of optimism by default. So just to argue for this, I'll show you some quotes by famous people. So here's Jim Peebles. I mean, you can imagine an era where the instrumental technology was nowhere near sensitive enough to measure the CMB. And there also appeared to be a ton of problems. We didn't know how bright the galaxy was going to be or how we would remove that contamination. Measuring the CMB power spectrum is, when you measure that, you're measuring variance, which instrumentally is just one of the most difficult things to measure and required a bunch of algorithmic tricks to pull off. So here's Jim Peebles finding it troublesome to imagine that such tiny that the CMB power spectrum could be observed. Saneyev was skeptical that the acoustic oscillation, the bumps in the power spectrum, would be observed. Now we think of the first few peaks as being sort of a calibrator for other things, like something we can just make an ideal measurement of to calibrate things that are more difficult. And here's Mukhanov putting the timescale of detecting the tilt as being of order 1,000 years when it was more like 20. So my new perspective is that you should be, even though there are a lot of hard problems, problems might seem difficult at first, but then you give a community of smart people, 10 or 20 years to think about them, and they tend to solve them, even if you don't see the answer right away. So unless you can see some fundamental reason, like some irreducible source of noise, or some very strong argument against an optimistic forecast, I'm going to take the position of optimism by default. So largely what we're trying to do is just enumerate extensions of the six-parameter model. Here are some parameters that I mentioned previously, and improve their parameter constraints to see what we observe. So the neutrino mass is a guaranteed signal. Neutrino oscillation experiments, we currently cannot observe a neutrino mass statistically different from zero, but neutrino oscillation experiments, as I'll explain a little later, indicate that the guaranteed minimum neutrino mass is around 0.06 eV. So we should eventually be able to observe something there. Many parameters on this list I'll describe as surprises. Surprise is, of course, a subjective term, and you may think that some of these parameters are more likely than others, but I think, so this is really sort of a statement about public opinion, but these parameters, I would say, are surprises in the sense that if you asked most people in the community to place betting odds on whether we would observe them, most people would bet against it. I think it's important to remember that dark matter and the cosmological constant were things that no one ever expected, that just emerged from taking better and better data. So I would personally say that the lesson from history is that you shouldn't place too much weight on theoretical bias on which parameters are more likely than others. The real lesson is that if you have the opportunity to do experiments which improve constraints on some reasonably well-motivated parameter by a large amount, say a factor of 10, you should just do the experiment and see what you get. Maybe after the experiment is over, we'll rearrange our understanding and our theoretical biases will be different. The specific case of the of R, the amplitude of cosmological gravity wave background, if one exists, I think is interesting because there you would find, again, this is just a psychological statement, but I think you would find the community sort of equally divided on whether we should expect to detect this parameter or not. And that question will tell us a lot about the early universe. And another key fact is that the observational constraints on this parameter are about to get much, much better. So I'll talk about this specific case shortly. I also want to make the point that it's very, I think, important to ask whether this list of parameters that we're looking for is complete. If we're missing something, then adding it to the list is a very valuable contribution. As an example, it's personally unclear to me. I didn't put any parameters on this list that are related to modifications of GR. You know, like one might say dark matter and a cosmological constant are surprises that we only observe gravitationally. And so it's not clear if collisionless dark matter and a strictly constant time-independent vacuum energy density are the only explanation. Perhaps, you know, recent theoretical ideas about massive gravity could be relevant. Perhaps they could mimic some of these effects. There are parameterizations in the literature, proposed parameterizations for modified gravity, but it's not clear to me whether they're really like the most optimal thing or the most complete thing that one ought to consider. So that's just an example of a direction one might think in asking whether this list of things to look for is complete. Okay, so I want to talk about R next, because I think this is really one of the exciting things that's going to happen soon. And in order to put this discussion in context, I'm going to have to give sort of a lightning review of inflation. So inflation was originally proposed as a solution to the horizon problem, which is just the statement that we observe a nearly isothermal CMB. If you plot, in absolute temperature, the most extreme cold spots and the most extreme hot spots in the CMB differ only in the third decimal place. However, so that suggests that the surface of last scattering, different parts of it could talk to each other to reach thermal equilibrium. But if we just take the expansion history of the universe that we know about, the matter plus radiation dominated part, then the causal horizon at the CMB, when the hot and cold spots were frozen in, was much smaller than the surface of last scattering, so that parts of the CMB that are separated by more than about a degree were never in causal contact. So inflation was proposed as a means of solving this problem. One can see, just from Friedman's equation, that if the usual radiation-dominated expansion is preceded by a stage of expansion where the pressure is sufficiently negative, then the causal horizon will become large at early times, leading different parts of the far separated parts of the universe to be in causal contact. So one source of negative pressure could be the potential energy of a scalar field. So to be a little more concrete, if we consider this is what's called single field slow roll inflation, if we suppose that in the very early universe, the energy density of the universe was dominated by the potential energy of a scalar field slowly rolling down a nearly flat potential. By nearly flat, I mean that these two parameters, the square of the log derivative in Planck units and the second derivative over the potential in Planck units, these parameters, epsilon and eta, I'm going to use a lot in subsequent slides. So if both of these parameters are small, then the horizon will be large at early times, solving the horizon problem. A more quantitative statement is that if you calculate, there's a famous calculation that shows that this simple model, this simple single field slow roll model, can also generate perturbations quantum mechanically that have the correct statistical properties to be the initial conditions of our universe. So if you start out in the slow roll inflationary background, and you also assume something about the quantum mechanical initial state, namely that it contains no particle-like excitations, this is what's called the Bunch-Davies vacuum, then quantum mechanics predicts that the expansion of the universe excites Fourier modes of the field, generates particles, and generates a Gaussian field with precisely the correct power law form to start our universe. And also predicts a Gaussian background of gravity waves that we can try to observe. So the ratio between the power spectrum of the gravity waves and the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation zeta is what's called R. I suppose I didn't really define it before. R is related to the slow roll parameters epsilon and eta by this equation. The other observable in this model is the power law exponent of the scalar perturbation, which is a different combination of eta and epsilon. It's sometimes said that inflation solves the initial conditions problem and that it generates perturbations with the desired statistical properties. I'll leave it to you to decide whether that's true. I think a sharper statement would be to say that if you assume that inflation starts out with a certain set of initial conditions, namely that it is on a classical slow roll trajectory with no particle-like excitations or that the density of particle-like excitations is sufficiently small, then starting from that choice of initial conditions, what you can get from there to the initial conditions that we want to explain. But you haven't really explained where the initial conditions for inflation that are put into this calculation might come from. So in that sense, inflation doesn't, it's not clear whether it really solves the initial conditions problem or just pushes it further back or perhaps to a more aesthetically appealing set of initial conditions. So this, I think, is sort of a foundational problem that deserves more attention. You know, one proposal, there's the Hartle-Hawking proposal, which gives sort of a more fundamental take on this. Perhaps there are others. This is something that I think has been understudied. Okay. Oh, that's a good question. Okay. So Lee is asking whether you get more, whether in this calculation you get more parameters out than you put in. Right. I would have to say, at least given our current understanding, I would have to admit that the answer is no. I mean in addition to this issue, we get to choose whatever potential we want, and if you're matching the observables are the spectral index, the scalar spectral index, and the gravity wave amplitude. And you're essentially matching two observed parameters to two parameters in the theory, which are the derivatives of the potential. So in a sense, the problem with inflation is that it's such a general framework that it's hard to rule out. It can more or less accommodate anything. You can put in different types of non-Gaussianity, multiple types of non-Gaussianity at the same time, all sorts of little features and wiggles into the power spectrum. And there will be some sufficiently convoluted model of inflation that will be consistent with those observations. It's hard to think of ways that we could rule out the general framework of inflation. I suppose if we observed gravity waves with a blue tilt, I don't personally know of a mechanism that would explain that. The tilt here is always is because epsilon is the square of V prime over V, NT is always positive. Another thing that I think would be, you couldn't really accommodate with inflation is if you observed a very narrow feature in the CLs, if you saw like a big spike at L of 4,000 that was gone by L of 4,010, then inflation, because even if you put a narrow feature in the potential, there tends to be a transient that lasts for a few E foldings. I don't see how you could accommodate that. But aside from these kind of, a few special cases, I think it's hard to, it's going to be hard to rule out inflation without some more concrete proposal for the microphysics or some more fundamental perspective on it. What's that? Oh, yeah, sure. Another problem is that even, if you have a model that naively predicts specific values for cosmological parameters, you tend to wander, as If inflation is eternal, then you end up generating patches with different, different inflationary patches with different cosmological parameters at the end of inflation. So that's another issue that complicates interpretation of its predictions. So here's a famous plot from the Planck paper that just takes different potentials. And this is really just to illustrate that for a given potential, I can compute these derivatives, locate them in the NSR plane. And so you see that many models, for example, a phi to the fourth potential would be up here and totally ruled out by the data. Now, what's going to improve in this plot in the near future, this is something that I think is really exciting, is the measurement of R, the y-axis in the plot. So now the 95% upper limit on R is 0.11 from Planck. That's coming from CMB temperature. The limit from CMB polarization is worse. It's around the 95% upper limit is about 0.7. If we ask what'll happen in the ultimate future, then the CMB temperature limit will remain the same because the relevant modes on large scales have been observed to their sample variance limit. But the CMB polarization limit will get much better, and my philosophy of optimism by default compels me to put this incredibly low number for how low we might be able to go in R. This is about how well you could do if you had an ideal measurement on the whole sky with all galactic foregrounds removed and the high L's measured as well to statistically remove Lensing contamination. That would be a stretch even for, I suppose, it would be inconsistent for me, given my earlier statement, for me to really argue against that. But that just seems like a bit too much of a stretch for me. We could talk about that later. So detection of gravity waves would be totally amazing. I mean, detecting these gravity waves that are generated in the early universe would really, it would be an amazing prediction of inflation. It would demonstrate that gravity is quantum mechanical. I mean, it's a quantum mechanical process that generates gravitons. So it's interesting to ask whether we expect to see a signal. I think this is sort of a fun topic for debate because you'll find the community kind of divided. So it's been argued, suppose that inflation is the correct model of the early universe. It's been argued that inflation generically predicts R of order 0.1, i.e. something that's detectable in upcoming experiments. And the argument for this is sort of the cartoon version, but I don't think it's too far from the full thing, is basically that for a generic potential, if you think of V of phi, we don't know what it is, but say it's some random function that you can randomly generate in different ways, for example, by assigning random values to its derivatives. Then, generically, you expect these two slow roll parameters to be of the same order. And given that we've already observed this combination to be different from zero, then unless there's some fine-tuning going on, we should expect R to be parametrically the same size as NS minus 1. It's also been argued that if inflation is the correct model, that you should generically expect tiny r. If you don't think of V of phi as being the random quantity, but you think of the energy scale of inflation. So the energy scale of inflation is related to R. It's a number of order to the gut scale times R to the 1/4. So if you think of the energy scale of inflation as being the unknown random parameter, that could really be anywhere between, say, the TeV scale and the current and the gut scale, which would come from the current upper limit on R. And so you'd have to get really lucky, given that enormous range of energies, you'd have to get really, really lucky for inflation to put you right at the upper end of the range where you could measure R. Finally, let me mention that alternatives to inflation, such as the ekparotic cyclic model, where perturbations are generated at low energies, unambiguously predict tiny r, so that the upcoming measurements will, I mean, these models are making a prediction that the upcoming measurements can either verify or not. I could talk more about the early universe, but I want to just in the last few slides talk about the large-scale structure era, because this is, I think, where the field is going. So the CMB has been really powerful, but we're running out of modes that we can measure. In the near future, large-scale structure observations will become more powerful than the CMB, at least for many parameters, basically because of mode counting. The CMB is a 2D field with maximum angular multipole of around 2,000 before the CMB gets too tiny to remove from foregrounds like dusty galaxies. So just naive mode counting of that 2D field gives you about 4 million modes. Large-scale structure has been harder to measure, but the experiments are making rapid progress, and will ultimately measure more modes. If I take some futuristic but not at all crazy values for the maximum wave number, or smallest wavelength that the experiments can measure, and maximum redshift, you get about 200 million modes, which tends to improve parameters, at least parameters that are sensitive to, with a few exceptions like the gravity waves that only come from the largest scales, tends to improve parameters by an order of magnitude or so. Finally, if I'm being sort of the ultimate optimist, I could imagine futuristic scenarios where you measure a large-scale structure at very high redshift, where the nonlinear scale where modes become hard to model is pushed out very far in K. And in this case, there's no real fundamental limit to how many modes we can measure, and it'll just be a case of building bigger and bigger telescopes until we can't do it anymore. The ultimate fundamental limit set by the Jeans scale of the neutral hydrogen gives you a number of modes of around 10 to the 18. So we can really go, for many parameters, much farther than we have, eventually, go much farther than we've gone with the CMB. So just as an example, the neutrino mass, this is an interesting example. So neutrino oscillation experiments, as you probably know, measure mass squared differences between species. These differences are very well measured, but there's an overall shift that's not measured by the oscillation experiments, an overall shift in M squared, which can be pinned down by cosmology because large-scale structure is mainly sensitive to the sum of the neutrino masses. The current upper limit on the sum of the neutrino masses is around 0.23 eV, which is a factor of a few away from the guaranteed signal from the neutrino oscillation measurements. It's unlikely that we'll beat this limit using the CMB, but next-generation large-scale structure experiments, I listed three experiments here that all forecast a statistical error in the neutrino mass of around 0.02 eV. These are experiments happening in the time frame of the next 5 to 10 years. So I want to conclude. So cosmology is entering the large-scale structure era, and all of us are kind of gearing up for this by thinking about the statistical and theoretical problems that will need to be solved. So I just want to conclude by showing a few slides of an example problem. And I'm doing this for a couple of reasons. One is the type of big picture talk that I've just given has the advantage of being inspiring, but the disadvantage of creating the impression that we're all just kind of sitting around waiting for the experimenters to tell us what W is or to tell us what R is. When in fact, these measurements depend on a lot of interplay between theoretical ideas and experiments, and there are a bunch of problems that need to be solved to make these measurements. So I want to talk about an example statistical problem that I don't claim to be I don't claim that this problem has special significance. I just want to leave you with an example of the type of problem that we try to solve. Just to give a sense of the flavor of research in this field. Okay, so large-scale structure data analysis is more difficult than the CMB, and the underlying reason for this is that the CMB is basically linear physics. Given the initial perturbation zeta, there's some complicated but computable linear mapping that generates the observed ALMs, and so CMB data analysis is largely just kind of a matter of making linear algebra, conceptually just a matter of making the linear algebra to go back and forth to make linear transformations between these different bases computationally efficient. Large-scale structure is difficult because nonlinear effects are more relevant. One can see, for example, that the process of gravitational collapse that processes these initial conditions into this density field Well, this density field is manifestly non-Gaussian, and so this process is significantly nonlinear. And this makes the data analysis kind of heuristic. It tends to be like this giant sausage machine where you put in this density field and do all sorts of different sub-analyses and then try to combine them, weighting them to get out the cosmological parameters you want with some big Monte Carlo pipeline relying heavily on simulations to characterize things. So there have been some really interesting recent theoretical developments that suggest that this complicated nonlinear process can be approximated by, in a simple way, freeing you from the need to use simulations. For example, here's a toy model which is surprisingly accurate. To get from the initial curvature perturbation to the density field at late times, the large-scale structure density field, you take your initial curvature perturbation zeta, filter it in Fourier space, and take the gradient to get a vector field. And then you use this vector field to displace a uniform grid of particles to get a non-uniform set of particle positions that you then Fourier transform or integrate to get the density field. So this process, this two-step process, is a nonlinear operation in the initial zetas. And so you might ask, this toy model doesn't include a lot of effects, but it includes many important nonlinear effects. And so you might ask, suppose that this toy model were the truth. I apply this toy model, and then I get to observe the density field to within some statistical noise. Like, say, I only get to observe the positions of some random subset of these particles. Then how would you invert this operation statistically? What's your best estimate for the initial curvature perturbation, and how would you characterize its statistical errors? That's a simple self-contained problem which is unsolved, and I actually think that solving it would make a lot of progress towards simplifying the way large-scale structure experiments are analyzed and improving their statistical errors. So this is also kind of a shameless advertisement that if you're interested in, if this sort of problem is interesting to you, come and talk to me about it, because I'd love to have collaborators. So that's it. This was kind of a few selected topics in cosmology, mostly looking to the future, that I think are interesting. Just to summarize, we have a six-parameter model. The conclusion of 30 years of experiments is that a simple six-parameter model describes a wide range of cosmological observations, but of course it encapsulates these six parameters, encapsulate surprises and deep mysteries that we still haven't fully understood. We're still in the era, cosmology has been driven in recent years by rapidly improving experiments, by rapidly improving statistical errors, and we're still in an era where this is happening. So in looking 10 years to the future, 20 years to the future, error bars are going to keep shrinking, and this may reveal more surprises and inform us further. But for this program to happen, there are a lot of problems in theoretical modeling, statistics, computation, in addition to these big picture problems like understanding what dark matter is that we need to solve. Thanks.